This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. And in just 2 days, the World Cup final will mark the end of a month-long tournament in which 32 teams from across the globe faced off to determine the world champion of football. Soccer fans from around the world tuned into matches in 12 cities in Brazil, yelling wildly, wearing elaborate gear, and assessing each kick. Why is this event such a spectacle every 4 years? And we will ask this question in only the way public radio can. We will talk about its impact on society and what it tells us about culture as a whole. We're not going to talk about the kick. Yes, we'll talk about sport because Lauren Dubois, as well as being a professor at Duke University, edits the Soccer Politics blog, and he is a huge fan, and he can tell us all about it. He's written for several publications, including The New Republic and Sports Illustrated, and is here to tell us more about soccer. Lauren, good to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
So tell us about that. You've written about the history of soccer, and sort of maybe the first question is, why has this or how has this become truly a worldwide sport?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's really a remarkable story. And I mean, soccer as a form is perhaps one of the cultural forms that spread the most rapidly and the most immediately kind of all over the globe. It's really a late 19th century phenomenon, and it takes over the course of the 20th century. And so now we have this event, the World Cup, which is really the largest event on the planet. More people will watch the final than have watched anything before in history this year. It's a kind of theater that unites people in a way that really nothing else does.
Why is that true? Why? I mean, it certainly is theater in that sense that we're all watching and we read a lot into it. How can it unite us all?
Well, it's partly a very compelling structure, which is a national – first of all, the nations kind of encounter one another on the pitch. It's probably the place in our lives where we see countries and nations take form in the most palpable way we ever do, right? It takes the form of these 11 players on the pitch. And the outcomes between nations are very clear. They happen before our eyes. It's a place, too, where the kind of global order of things can be upended. It's not the same as the global order of power and money. Small nations like Costa Rica can suddenly be in the final rounds of a tournament. And so I think that's a kind of pleasure too. And finally, I think it allows people to make connections and to affiliate themselves in ways that are not usual.
Yeah, and you've made the point too in your pieces that you've written for The New Republic and again for Sports Illustrated that it's a way in which every country kind of claims soccer as their national sport at the same time. Mm-hmm. It is the world sport.
Exactly. I mean, it's a sport that in very concrete ways is actually an English sport. And we should note that actually at the beginning, American football, rugby, and what's known as football globally are all come out of the same soup, basically, which is English schools of the 19th century. So it's a form kind of created in a very specific context, but somehow it becomes indigenous in all kinds of societies. So for Africans, for Brazilians, and now and more for Americans, it feels like our sport.
And then you talk about the theatrical content of this, the dramatic value of this game. And you've actually described the two main categories of villains, mm-hmm. right? The referee and the goalie.
Right. Well, I mean, that's part of what makes it so dramatic is you have on the pitch, you can feel like when you're watching every emotion from exhilaration, joy, happiness to incredible anger, villains and heroes, all in 90 minutes and often in very confusing and ambiguous ways.
How so? I mean, why, it shouldn't be confusing and ambiguous. Look, it's a sport. I kick the ball into the net. Mm-hmm. I get a point and we move forward, right?
Well, one of the – what I think is actually the most fascinating and perhaps enthralling things about soccer is that often the best team doesn't win, right? And that can be very frustrating for people who are looking for justice on the field. But the fact is it's a very low-scoring game. Often almost all games or a majority of games are won by 1 point. And those points are often won against the flow of the game, sometimes by a bad call by the referee, which when you look back was completely off. And that happens a lot. It doesn't just happen occasionally. And so people have to deal with the kind of injustice and unluckiness and just sort of flat out implausibility of outcomes all the time in soccer.
And there are two different styles of villain. I mean, it's clear to see how referees are villains. They make bad mm-hmm. calls. Clearly, they had it in for the other team. You can impute all kinds of evil and menace in there. Intent. Goalies, on the other hand, they just didn't do so well. Mm-hmm. That's a different sort of villain, I guess,
right.
In a way.
Yeah, and goalies are more ambiguous. I mean, I think people are gentler with goalies and in a certain way, but it's also true that sometimes, I mean, if a goalie makes a mistake, it's so clear, and occasionally they make these huge mistakes, and it's so clear, and because that can be the end of a World Cup run, it's often directed at them. Of course, we've seen in the past in this tournament some incredible performances by goalies, Tim Howard being the most recent one for the U.S. And it kind of – for them, I think they can also become heroes in a certain way. But what's so horrible is that they can do everything right for almost all the game, and then one error ends it all.
What about the – is this a sport that only makes sense in the era of the nation state?
It does, and I think it really is the product. I mean, in that sense, it's very much the product of the 19th century, and the World Cup is really the product of the aftermath of World War I. I mean, this is very much – it's a project in line with, like, the League of Nations, with the ultimate dream of the United Nations. It's the same period that gives rise to the Olympics. These are people who are dreaming of a way in which nations can kind of interact and even fight with one another without causing so much harm, without causing so much death. So some form of national pride and cosmopolitan understanding is what the founder of the World Cup, who was a Frenchman named Jules Rimet, really dreamed it would become.
You, Lauren Dubois, are, of course, a big fan of Belgium, mm-hmm. being Belgian in extraction yourself. So here's the thing, and I guess this is what you were getting at, because, you know, I mean, quite honestly, since Belgium, you know, lost to Congo, hasn't been able to climb back up on the stage, but here you are. You know, there's always a potential every 4 years, but at least the potential when the tournament starts, mm-hmm. to be back right there front and center.
Right.
Know? Yeah.
And I think it's, you know, so the Belgian team is an example, I think, because while, of course, it was very, very hurtful for many Americans to lose to Belgium, but the way that game was played, I think, left many people respecting the other side. The captain of the team complimented Tim Howard afterwards. There was a kind of sense that you don't see in a lot of other games, actually, of a certain affection or respect between the teams. And so that can make a difference. So now when people think – beforehand, of course, everybody was talking about not eating waffles or drinking Belgian beer, you know, trying to get angry about Belgium, evoking the Congo and so forth. But after the math, if the game goes a certain way, people can leave with a different sense of a place and a certain respect for the opponent.
So we talked about that. And the fact is that these games remain in the national conscience in a way, and you point that in consciousness, and you point out sometimes a military victory and defeat is less painful than a loss in the World Cup.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and this is something, of course, we've heard about all tournament long, is the particular case of Brazil, which lost the World Cup final in 1950, in the last time the World Cup was in Brazil. So this hangs over this World Cup pretty seriously. But people remember that as a real, real tragedy. And I think it's partly because, again, it's different type of victory from a military victory, because in a sense, if a country wins the World Cup like France did in 1998, there is a moment of unity and joy in that country that nothing else can produce, basically. You know, sort of everybody feeling like they participated. And people remember those kinds of victories forever in a way. So the sense of not having them taken away can also be, of course, really strong. The crazy thing, of course, is that most of the World Cup for most fans is tragic, right? Because only one team wins. Everyone's going to lose at some point. You could see that some teams like Algeria, which went further than ever before in this tournament, they took advantage of how well they did and really celebrated, even though they did go out of the tournament.
Only very few teams can say, well, we did well to get this far. Mm-hmm. Most, you know, it's either win or lose. I think, you know, I confess I'm not much of a fan. But if I do look at some of these theatrical aspects and some of the sort of the human cultural phenomena, the fact that this really points to our ability to be a fan, to be committed to an idea. This abstract mm-hmm. thing, even though it's played out on an actual field or a pitch, as you might say, mm-hmm. if you were a fan. You know what? The cool thing for me is the absolute slowness of it. So mm-hmm. if you're talking about the aspiration in the aftermath of World War I to end war forever, it's good. That's a long and tedious process. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of back and forth, and, you know, you may not get a victory. You may not get mm-hmm. a goal. To me, that's what that game represents. It's like mm-hmm. if I'm going to spend a lot of time trusting a process, soccer's my game.
Uh-huh. Yeah, you do have to trust it. Many games end in draws, 0-0. You know, and there can be riveting games that have no goals, which is hard for people to get sometimes. The other thing I think is the intricacy of the emotions that go on during a game, and that's partly where the fun comes in. The fact of kind of diving and cheating and trying to trick the ref, the fact of interacting with each other, which again, often some American commentators don't like, is a core part of the game. It's something that people enjoy watching and commenting on. It's one of the things that makes it dramatic. These are actors as well as athletes. And if you are supporting a team and one of them is a really good actor, you can often like that about them.
Yeah, and so it's how the game is played within the rules, but as you suggest, it's how you can work around the edges, and mm-hmm. so you sort of make hash of the fact of a rule, because watch this, we can break a rule and win. Mm.
And the rules are so ambiguous. It's why the referees, I mean, one has to be really sympathetic to them because they don't have instant replay in soccer. They've finally, for this World Cup, introduced goal line technology. But frequently in the past, goals have been scored or not scored, and the referees made the wrong choice. But the referees have to make instantaneous decisions. They don't have the benefit of hindsight or of replays. And so they're often just acting, you know, as the best they can on the pitch, and the result is many errors.
Tell us about that goal line technology. We've got lasers or something.
It's something in the ball, and sort of it essentially allows a computer to see whether the ball fully went across the line completely for sure, without depending on visual angles and so forth.
And then the makeup of the teams. I mean, you talk about the American team being this, some of the high profile players being German and American and African American. And this is a feature of soccer, truly multinational, multiracial teams, mm-hmm. and individuals.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, these are, I mean, as far as representatives of nations go, these are more diverse than any parliament. You know, if you look at the groups that go on the field, you'll see a kind of reflection of a population that often is not seen in the political class, for instance. And at the same time, it is a representative for the country. It's also a little different from the Olympics in that, I mean, as many Olympic athletes are individuals. This is a collective. So you can kind of see how does, you know, sort of a descendant of, in the Belgian case, a descendant of Congolese immigrants, you know, interact with a Flemish player, and this kind of collective group, which I think people love about the American team too, is really enriching.
So there's all that diversity. On the other hand, it is all male.
True. Yep. It is all male, and that's the one sort of most intense form of exclusion about this. Now, it should be said that the Women's World Cup is next year in 2015. It also should be said that the United States has won the World Cup twice. With its women's team is more successful than its men's team. And women's soccer in the last tournament and in the next tournament, I think, is going to increasingly become really powerful. And that's quite important. But it's also true that there's still a deep sexism in the way that the commercials of the World Cup and the way the World Cup's covered and the way that women are talked about in the World Cup. At the same time, the World Cup has a huge fan base of women who watch it, perhaps more than a lot of other male professional sports for the reasons we've discussed.
And so there you get, again, the law and its its transgression, the idea that this is about nation states. It's about Argentina and Brazil and the U.S. and England. And yet the teams and the players are, you know, famously drawn from mm-hmm. all over. And so what we see playing out is an aspiration to multinationalism within the very restrained confines mm-hmm. of, you know, nation state identity.
Mm-hmm. And more there's a lot of slipperiness here. So actually, the Algerian team this year was an example. There were 16 players on that team who were actually born, raised, and trained in France. They were the children of Algerians. That's an extreme case. But the American team, actually the players who scored a lot of the stunning goals are Germans. I mean, they're really Germans. They're the child of Americans who grew up in Germany and grew up in that context. They have a link to the United States. So a lot of teams are like that. On the other hand, a team that may seem like it's constituted of many foreign players, like the Belgian team, is all Belgians. These are kids who all grew up in Belgium. Their parents had come from different horizons. So it's sometimes a little different than what people think on the surface.
What about the image of soccer being the ultimate democratic sport, in that any kid can pick up a ball and get a team together in the poorest of neighborhoods, unlike tennis and golf, where you have to have access to the courts and mm-hmm. to the links. On the other hand, I guess to really finish, you have to go to an academy. I mean, that's where some of these players come from.
More and more, of course, the intensity is to form people in the academies. It is true. It's a very democratic sport in the sense that you can play with nothing. I mean, you can play anything that can just look like a ball, and it doesn't even have to be a flat pitch. It can be anything. So even compared to football or basketball would be the closest analog. It's also true that physical body types in soccer are extremely varied, and that's a kind of important thing to keep in mind. There are soccer players of all sizes and shapes. They're all very well fit, obviously. But I always say, like, if you saw Lionel Messi in an ill-fitting suit, you'd think he was an accountant. You know, you wouldn't think this is the most highly paid prized athlete in the world. And so that's key. More and more, of course, the academy systems and the investments that are going into this. You can see that paying off. And one of the reasons that Belgium, Germany, France are at this stage of the tournament is partly because they have really strong state-supported project to develop soccer in their countries.
What about – you've also written about the corruption of football around mm-hmm. the world, the fact that you can sort of sponsor these games and be in the spotlight like Brazil and perhaps hide some of your blemishes in the process.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, the corruption is enormous, and the debates about this are just getting more and more. I mean, there was once upon a time, you know, FIFA was a small organization in Switzerland that organized soccer matches, and that is actually at the end of the day their job. But the amount of money that goes into this now with the viewing rights and so forth is so huge, and the stakes – and involved and who gets to host the World Cup. And all that has kind of led to this creation of this kind of strange institution that has very, very little transparency. No one really knows what's going on there. They don't feel accountability to their constituency, which after all is global football fans, who also don't really have any way of affecting them. And so you see it's a structure of governance that's really problematic, and more people are upset about that.
So to what extent, I mean, so we're globalizing in a couple of ways. We've got Olympics, we've got the World Cup, and that's a way for all of us to just, you know, sit in front of a flat screen and share a moment of joy with our friends. We have global capitalism, a global economy now that is in one way or another uniting us. I mean, are these worlds coming together, and do we see any of that reflected in soccer?
I think so. I mean, one of the things I think you see with the World Cup in particular is that it's a very simple thing, but people like to be together around something, right? And the World Cup, and you see this year in the United States more than ever with people going to Soldier Field or in the streets. That is how a lot of people like to watch the game, in a large crowd. And it is a game that lends itself to that because although it's complex, there's also a clarity to it. When a goal is scored, it happens once or twice or a few times in a game. Everyone can cheer. So I think you see the desire for people to come together around certain things. Perhaps as a countervailing tendency precisely to the kind of alienation that so much of our social order creates. So I think what you see is a kind of tension there, and soccer embodies that tension. It's at once completely corporatized, capitalized, at once corrupt in all kinds of ways, and at the same time it seems to point to community, play, joy, understanding. And that contradiction, I think, is what makes it very powerful.
What about the fact that in the United States we're seeing more and more fans? Obviously, I don't know, but I would guess that the largest growth in soccer fans would be the United States, just because we're coming to it kind of late. Does that make a difference, these longtime fans who understand the brawling and what it means to have the English on the other side of the, side of the pitch? And then these kind of newfound fans who only saw it for the first time on a flat screen.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, does that make a difference to the game?
I think it does make a difference. And everyone comes to a game with different things. I mean, we all have different educations. If I bring a French person to watch the Durham Bulls game, they're completely befuddled, have no idea what's going on. So an education helps because you can understand the layers. You know, the thing about this is it just repeats. It goes on and on and on. There's games every 4 years, et cetera. So, but each game is kind of in this history. And in some ways, you can kind of enjoy it more if you know some of that history and the players. Of course, it's also relatively easy for people to learn that. American soccer fans are actually interesting because they read a ton. They love these tournaments. Actually, both South Africa and Brazil, the largest number of foreigners at those tournaments are Americans. On the one hand, it's not our lead sport. On the other hand, as fans, we're very invested in it. And of course, the last games this year have garnered bigger audiences than ever before.
I would say the fact that you have a couple of pieces on soccer in the New Republic, not famous for its sports coverage, suggests a couple of things. A, the growing fan base, and B, the fact that we like to read about it as much as we do watch the game.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and in this sense, it connects with the tradition of sort of baseball writing in America. But there's a space in soccer for all kinds of commentary. And the sports media itself kind of focuses on a pretty narrow band. But what you see in the past years through blogging, and this is why I've developed the blog and students at Duke are writing for that blog, there's a space for all kinds of commentary that's not covered by the normal sports media, and that's really exploding right now.
Lauren, always a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Lauren Dubois is a professor of Romance Languages at Duke University. He edits Soccer Politics blog and is the author of Soccer Empire. Just ahead on The State of Things, the music of Africa Unplugged. Stay tuned.